Welcome to a very special edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with the legendary alto saxophonist Charles McPherson. He's originally from Joplin, Missouri, but he got baptized in the jazz while living in Detroit as a boy. And he got some sage advice in life and in the great art of jazz from Barry Harris, along with witnessing amazing cats like Miles Davis play live. He spent 12 years with the great and explosive Charles Mingus and has played with a huge host of luminaries and jazz cats over the years. He's getting ready to release a new album called The Journey in February 2015, and the journey through his life is rich and interesting, and we discussed it at length. Charles possesses an amazing arsenal of story, intelligence, and warmth. He's a jewel in the annals of jazz history. It was our pleasure, so please dig this interview, my friends.
Hello, Charles McPherson here.
Yeah, hi, Charles. It's Joe Domino with Neon Jazz.
Yeah, hey, Joe. How you doing?
How are you, sir?
Very good, very good. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thank you for taking a little time out to talk with us.
No problem.
I'm going to go ahead and start off the bat here about what's been going on lately. Talk to me about your brand new album, The Journey.
Yeah, well, it was an album that was done in Denver a few months back, and there's a club called Dazzles, a very nice jazz club, and I was working there, and some of the musicians that were in the rhythm section at the club, and also one of the tenor players that was playing with me, we all decided to maybe record our gig, record our getting together. And so, and then there's a company in there called Capri, owned by Tom Burns. And he was interested in recording the group. And so that's what we did. So we worked the club. Mm-hmm. We only worked a couple days. And then we were in the studio for a day or so, and we recorded. And the musicians were, good musicians, fun people to play with. And so why not document it? And that's what we did.
Right on. I've got an advanced copy. It's a beautiful album.
Oh, thank you so much.
Absolutely. And I was curious, too, about this Afro-Cuban jazz ballet, the Sweet Synergy Suite. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Okay, now this came about. First of all, my daughter's is a ballet dancer with the San Diego Ballet, one of the ballet companies here in San Diego.
Yeah.
So she's a professional dancer, and I was the one taking her back and forth to ballet lessons since she was about 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so she turned into the ballerina.
Yeah.
And she was with this company. Now, this came about by way of a grant that there's it's called the San Diego Foundation Creative Catalyst Fund. Now, these people fund artists in the San Diego area, and they bestow money, grant money. Now, in order for the grant to be satisfied, these people want you to partner with one other artist, and the partnership is supposed to bring about a project that reflects both partners doing something out of the box, something out of the ordinary, out of their comfort zone.
Sure.
So for me, since I'm a musician and I play and I write music, okay, the dance company and the choreographer, he constructs dances. So the out of the box for both of us was for me to write for a ballet. And the kind of music that I'm writing is I'm a bebop jazz musician. So I just decided to play Afro-Cuban music along with the bebop and write for ballet, movement. And that's my, this is something I don't normally do. At least I don't write for dance. And the choreographer is basically a classical ballet guy. Likes usually ballet moves for classical ballet and that genre, but now he's dealing with Afro-Cuban Latin rhythms and jazz rhythms. So that's his out of the comfort. Making him be out of his comfort zone there.
Sure.
And that's what the grant wanted. Wanted you to do something you don't normally do and to partner with someone else. So, okay. So part of satisfying the grant was to put on a workshop.
Cool.
After the project is completed. Okay, so we did that already last April.
Right on.
Now, this dance company decides to put on this whole thing during their regular season, which will be in February. And so that's what we're going to do. So that project came about by way of my dancer being with the company and then me being a partner with these people. The choreographer, his name is Javier Velasco, very, very, very smart, talented man, who was able to put together dance moves to go with my music.
So we're coming out of Kansas City here. You're relatively local from Joplin. Talk to me a little bit about...
Is that where you are in Kansas City?
Yes, sir. Yeah, we're in Kansas City, Missouri.
Oh, great. Okay, well, I'm from Joplin, Missouri. I was born there. And I moved from Joplin in 1948 to Detroit. And then the rest of my childhood was in Detroit.
And that's what I was going to get to. They said that you saw some festivals in the early years when you were there in Joplin. What were those like? How did the jazz move you in those early years in Joplin?
Well, you know, these early years means I was probably 5, 6, 7, 8 years old.
Yeah.
Okay. So... there was a park in Joplin, Missouri, whereas every August they had a celebration called Emancipation Day. Okay, mm-hmm. And that was celebrated in this park in the African American community. And what they would do, would be a gala affair, but they would always have bands, probably territorial bands. You know, in fact, most definitely the bands that were in the Midwest, South Central, USA, you know. So I'm sure these bands were from Kansas City and Oklahoma and all those places like that. So these were the kind of bands that would play this park and this particular event every August. And I was enamored of the music, of course, and certainly of the shiny brass instruments. And so that was my first exposure to live jazz music at a very early age, and so I always liked it. But I didn't really start playing music myself until we moved from Joplin to Detroit in 1948, and I was about 10 years old, and I didn't start playing until junior high school. And I was 12 years old when I started playing in the band. And then that was, from that point on, I played trumpet first. And then a year later at 13, I played saxophone. And from that point on, I knew I wanted to play music. Introduced to Charlie Parker by a young guy in the band who already knew about Bird, and I didn't. He sort of told me about him, and I heard him box, and that's when I fell in love with it, all of it.
So when you heard Charlie Parker for the first time, did it just blow your top? Was it like, oh my God, this is...
Oh yeah, definitely. I was about 14 years old, and I heard this record. It was Tico Tico, one of the records Bird made with Norman Grant in those days, and it was just, I think it was a series of recordings South of the Border. They were named South of the Border, so it's dealing with Latin and Afro-Cuban rhythms, and Machito and Chico Farrell and all those people. And so that was one of the first records I heard of Bird, was Tico Tico. And I immediately became very enamored of not only of Bird, but also that whole genre of music. So I discovered that, yes, this is jazz. It's a certain kind of jazz played by a bunch of people who play that genre of jazz. Well, at that point, then I wanted every record I could find, not only of Charlie Parker, but of anybody that played that kind of music. So it was Charlie Parker, Miles, Dizzy Gillespie, Stan Getz, Stan Kenton, you know, all these people. And then just that genre, they called it progressive jazz and bebop and whatever you want to call it in yeah. those days. And it was kind of, you know, the next new music after swing and the big band. And I just fell in love with that whole genre and the players that played it. And so from that point on, I'm seeking records out, finding out who plays this. And then I find out there's a club right down the street from my house. I can walk there in 5 minutes that features that kind of music. And this is in Detroit. The club's called Bluebird.
Yeah.
Wow. And from that point on, I'm 14, 15 years old. It's like, okay, right down the street from my house is where this music is played. And it's a great local jazz club. The musicians who played in that club were, the house band was Elvin Jones on drums, Pepper Adams, baritone, Thad Jones, trumpet. A slew of people that would come through there, like Sonny Stitt or Miles, or there was a great tenor player named Billy Mitchell that played there all the time, wow. Wardell Gray. So all these great jazz musicians. With a lot of them lived in Detroit, so they played there. And then people coming through from New York would play there as well. So I'm in heaven at
wow.
this point. And
yeah.
I'm too young to get in. I just stand outside the place and listen. But that was my early beginnings. And then I met Barry Harris, who was the pianist in this club. And he happened to live right around the corner, and I started studying with him. By the time I was 19, I was playing professionally. And then I played around town, colleges and dances and proms. And then I was able to play in some of the clubs. I put on a little mascara on my mustache and look a little older because I wasn't 21.
Yeah.
And then I went to New York and started working with Mingus in 1960.
Wow. What was it like to be around Barry Harris? What did he teach you about life?
Well, he was an excellent teacher about music, so I learned a lot about harmony and theory and, things about music. In terms of life, he opened up a door, an intellectual door, that I didn't care or know so much about. And basically, he created a sense of reading habit. Because I was 14, it's not like I read a lot of books, other than, books you read in school. But because he was a person that was pretty enlightened in a lot of ways other than just music, he actually instigated that kind of thing in me as well, because he would... one day I came in, sort of an interesting story, and I had my report card. He saw it. He said, "Hey, let me see your report card." So I showed him the card. It was a bunch of C's. In those days it was A, B, C, D,
Yeah.
I don't know what it is now. But anyway, so C is like the average grade, right? So the whole report card was C's everywhere. No A's, no B's, just C's. And he saw that. He said, "Well, you're kind of an average guy, aren't you?" And I didn't even hear the insult in that. I said, "Well, yeah, I'm not below average, so I'm okay."
Yeah. Okay.
And so he says, "Well, nah, I've got to tell you something. The kind of guys that you admire, these musicians that you respect, are anything but average.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to be an average guy or student and be able to play this kind of music. Maybe some other kind. But not this, because you got to have too much stuff going to be able to have the weather at all, to play, negotiate all these rhythms and harmony and be creative and think on your feet and all this stuff. It's anything but ordinary and average. There's no C-suit stuff here. So all these people that you like, Charlie Parker, and these kind of people, basically these people are actually brilliant. You're going to have to tighten up your game." Now, when he said that to me, that was the first. I never, that meant more coming from him than it would my parents,
Yeah.
And because here's a guy that, he's a hero and I respect him. And it was like, "Oh, really?" And so from that point on, I started to read. And he would say, "Now, let me see you do the puzzle. So he was a guy who did the New York Times puzzle all the time.
Yeah.
And he could do it fast, Sunday puzzle, you know, a half hour.
Yeah.
So he's this kind of guy, and this is, you know, he knew words and all these weird, you know, words you have to look. And so he said, let me see you start doing that. And when you see something, a word you don't know, look in the dictionary. And
yeah.
So I started doing it because he said it, you know?
Yeah.
And so after a while, I'm learning all these odd words that are, you know, dictionary words, Scrabble words, you know. And then I would listen to the musicians that would come over to his house, and they would all talk music, but every now and then they'd talk about things that had nothing to do with music. So there would be conversations about Nietzsche, Schopenhauer, Immanuel Kant, Bertrand, it would be Spinoza, it would be these, Ayn Rand, it would be conversations dealing with politics, philosophy, sometimes it'd be about quantum mechanics, and I'm saying, well, damn, I had no clue that music, you know, these people who would know, would be this eclectic, or this, have this much dimension as people. Because I'm just thinking of them as jazz musicians. So this was impressive to me also. And then I started reading about quantum mechanics and, you know, Max Planck and, you know, this and that and the different, you know, Nietzsche and what is he talking about? What is his slant on things? And, you know, because they're doing it. And
yeah.
This is how Detroit musicians were. They were, like, really smart, brilliant people that could play, but these people were well-rounded as people, you know, not just music. These guys were really something, and they were impressive for a guy 14, 15 years old. And so when I saw that, I said, well, to me, okay, I want to be in with this. And so I did. So I never thought that way as a kid. You know, I didn't care anything about that. But by the time I was out of high school, I was like an A student. You know, my report card was all, you know, like the teachers couldn't believe it because they already had me pigeonholed as a, well, he's a fair student, that's it.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden these A's start popping up. And I can remember one of the homeroom teachers in it because they were handing out the report cards and they saw my card, they saw these A's. And they were like, Charles, come here. And I, what happened? You got all these A's? And of course, I didn't say all of what I'm saying to you. I just said, well, yeah, I just decided to sort of tighten up a little. And they were like, oh, that's beautiful. Anyway, so that was the last 2 years of high school. I just sailed through there. I mean, it just totally changed my life. So Barry Harris and jazz music actually changed the course of how I thought, not only musically, but in general.
Yeah, absolutely. So by the time you're 19 and you get your first bit of live performing, were you nervous? How did you go into your first real live gig?
Well, you know, yes, I was nervous, but I was well, sort of well prepared because I would go over to Barry's house every day. He lived right around the corner, and we learned all the, you know, American songbook. We learned standards, we learned jazz, we learned harmony, and we became very well prepared. So when it came to playing gigs, we were prepared. You know, we played dance music and we knew the tunes to play. Now, when I first started working with Mingus, this is the beginning of, if you will, like an international career or a name band. This was the beginning of, you know, some, you know, this is the beginning of it. Stress, happiness, and everything else. So I worked with Mingus and for about 12 years, and Mingus was a very difficult guy to work for. He was very confrontational and sort of, what would you call it, explosive, you know, he could be, but brilliant, and his music was, you know, insightful. And so I learned a lot about composing. That was the thing that impressed me most about me. Mingus, his composition, you know. And I worked with him 12 years off and on. And basically, I cut my professional teeth, at least beginning in New York, with Mingus.
Right on. What now you played with a lot of other people over your career. Paul Chambers, Tommy Flanagan, Duke Jordan. The list goes on and on and on. Are there any that really stick out in your brain, like Mingus, where you really learned a lot, you really kind of cultivated some very core senses of jazz and arranging and playing and composing? Are there any in that list that really leap out?
All of them. You know, everything informs everything else. And your whole musical life or your life period, you know, every little thing, big or small, contributes to the whole. So it's hard to say. I mean, certainly the experience with Mingus, because it was 12 years pretty much, that was insightful because of who he is and who he was. And in terms of composition, I think I really learned, or I was influenced by him to a degree in that way. And Barry Harris certainly is another very strong personality in my musical life and beginnings. The journey on the way playing with different people, all of it was interesting. I remember certain things that left an impression on me that I remember to this day. So everybody, you know, these people are wonderful people, really. And they, you know, when you are around them, you know, there are tidbits of information, nuances, and things that you remember. You know, musical phrases, or you can picture a particular evening with this person or that person. And it's all informing the you, meaning me, you know. So, I've worked with Jamie Chan, for instance, the piano player that Bert played with.
Yeah.
We had a gig once in Europe, and we were on the bandstand. And there were some kind of problems with, there were technical problems with the sound. So we couldn't start performing right away. We had to wait, you know, say 5 minutes or so, if not a little longer, until the glitches, they were taken care of. So you got a whole band. It was a big band. I remember that. And Jamie Chan was the pianist. So we're on stage, and people are in the audience waiting, and everybody knows that there's a couple of technical things that have to be taken care of. So while that was happening, Jamie Chan started to meander on the piano. Nothing in particular. He's just taking up time and sort of doing something while everyone, including the audience, is waiting for things to be fixed. Now, the thing about it is, what he was meandering with on the piano was nothing to do with how you think of Jamie Chan, the blues player from Kansas City, because he's a great blues player, right?
Yeah.
Everything that he was just roaming around the piano. And it basically was Debussy.
Yeah.
You know, and it was this gorgeous music meandering in this, or either like Chopin, with all this whole vibe, if you will.
Yeah.
And it was like everybody in the band looked, and we were like, damn, you wouldn't even think that a guy like Jay McShann would even, you know, it wouldn't be on his radar to even think this or even do this on the piano. But it was.
Yeah.
And I never forgot that. It was like, wow, the world thinks of this guy as the blues guy, and he is that. But boy, he's got a lot more dimension than what most people know. And it was impressive because it was good.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah. I was in, so that's just one moment. It only lasted, 5 minutes? But I'll never forget it.
Wow.
Because it was gorgeous, you know, and unexpected. So, you know, little things like that happen over the course of 50 years all over the place, you know.
Yeah, that's a beautiful story. So,
yeah.
As a musician, you've always been a growing, innovating force in jazz. What is your key? What's your music philosophy?
Well, my music philosophy is, let me see, how do you say this? It's a journey, you know, music is finite. You know, there's only so many chords, so many scales, and so it's finite. It's there, and there are 12 notes in the chromatic scale, at least in Western music. One can learn the elements and the infrastructure, and all of this stuff about music. But that's not even, the main event is, it's a really a journey into yourself, a journey in self. And I mean, what I mean by that is it becomes getting the best out of yourself. And that is, that's, you know, that's a state of becoming. Music has already become. The elements are there. The person, the human being that's using music to express, that is that the journey is of the human being, the evolution of personality and consciousness within the individual person. That becomes, that's the war, or if you will, that is the thing to conquer is self. You know what I mean? So,
yeah. So
that's the fun of it. And the other thing of it is, when you think of music, not only in a template, say a Western template or an Eastern template or any of these types of music that's reflected around the world, if you just think of the notes, period. You know, a D is a D. I don't care if it occurs in in rock and roll, or if it's a D that Bach play, a D is a D in the scale. Okay, so you got, but when you look at music beyond that, you're looking at it as a phenomenon, a universal phenomenon, in fact, a cosmic phenomenon. And that's how I actually look at tone and music, because all it is vibration,
Yeah.
And so a famous scientist once said, the phenomenal physical universe, as we know it, basically is frozen music. And that's exactly right, because everything is vibrating. Everything is moving.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as solidity
or
non-movement. Everything is moving. You know, electrons, physical matter is a bunch of electrons and stuff bouncing and shimmering and vibrating all over the place.
Absolutely.
Well, all a note is exactly that. You know, A440 on the piano means 440 cycles per second.
Mm-hmm.
That's what makes A and not D.
Yeah.
D is vibrating at... Okay, so the whole universe is vibrating some sort of way. So it's music, okay, so now I look at music in a cosmic way, not just a local way, or it's a cosmic universe. It's a cosmic phenomenon in a way. So I look at it that way, and then I look at the evolution of personality and personal style in terms of the human factor. So I'm thinking of that in terms of myself, and then I'm thinking of the whole music universe, cosmic way of thinking of vibration. So all of it is one to me, and so the journey is, how do you take vibration tones, sequence them rhythmically, do this or that with them, and how many thousands of ways can you find ways to do things?
Wow.
And that's the fun of it for me.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's amazingly cool. I love the way you orchestrated that. That's great.
Yeah, and it sounds corny. You know, it sounds like 1960. But it's really the truth. I mean, this is really how I think about it.
No, that's just a brilliant way of looking at it. That's the way I see it. So in 1988, Clint Eastwood's film Bird, you got to be the sax voice, and you got to play Parker. What was that like, to come full circle after all these years in the realm of bebop and looking up to Bird and then playing him? Was that totally cool?
Well, it was very interesting. At this point, I'm more, because, I've been in love with Bird, so that, so for me, the project, just to try to do the project and do a good job, that became, that this is what I'm actually thinking about. And so the experience was different, because this is Hollywood, and you're dealing with movies and soundtrack and what they call click tracks, and that's a whole different way of using music. And so that was interesting. I met Clint Eastwood. He was there at the record. I wasn't at any of the footage of the when they were shooting the film, but when they recorded some of the soundtrack, I'm in the studio. I did tutor the actor Forrest Whitaker on how to look like he's playing the saxophone.
Yeah.
And, you know, how to hold it. So, you know, you had to try to do a good job of blowing, because a lot of times it would be burned. Some of the things they were able to use of Charlie Parker, some things they were not because of the technology or either copyright problems or this, you know, that kind of thing. And that's when I was used.
Gotcha.
And they couldn't technically use Bird, or if there were problems with the copyright or something, you know. Or when there wasn't any footage or any documentation. For instance, there was a scene of Charlie Parker and Red Rodney playing up in the mountains in New York for some of the Jewish resorts up there. Red Rodney and Bird did do that. That really happened. And there's no documentation. None of that was recorded. But Clint Eastwood featured that, you know, that in the film, part of the film. And so I was used for that.
Yeah.
And then basically it was a scene in there about a Jewish wedding, you know. Yeah. And Bird and Red Rodney actually did play a wedding up there.
Wow.
In the mountains. And so I was used for that because there's no documentation of Charlie Parker playing that or Red Rodney. But it happened. So little scenes like that. Another interesting scene was this actually happened. Charlie Parker was riding in the car with a lady, and they were riding around in Hollywood in that Beverly Hills, you know, rich section. And they were looking at all the mansions of movie stars and all that. It was in the evening. And they came, and Bird didn't have a hell of a lot of interest. You know, he's kind of looking, oh, yeah, it's Douglas Fairbanks' house. Or one. But when it came to Stravinsky's house, he wanted to stop. He said, oh, wait, let me stop. So they stopped. This really happened. And Bird saw the guy out of the car and just stared at the house for a few moments, you know, because this is Igor Stravinsky's house.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked, and he got back in the car, and they went on, you know. But so Clint Eastwood used this. So what he did, he had an idea, and this happened in the studio, is when this was happening in the film, showing Bird looking at Stravinsky's house, they played Stravinsky's Firebird Suite. And I superimposed just Kansas City Blues right on top of that.
Wow.
So that was kind of a novel and a very ethereal kind of an effect to hear Stravinsky, you know, his Firebird Suite, and then hearing this Kansas City Charlie Parker type blues, you know, superimposed on this, on Stravinsky's tune.
Yeah.
And that brought about a very ethereal, very interesting kind of the whole thing was interesting. It was clearly not his idea to do that. I thought that was artful and very effective for that scene right there. So, you know, it was used that way.
Well, let me ask you a question. Do you like being famous?
Well, I'm not that famous, you know, so it's not like when you say famous, you know, you got these levels of infamy, if you will. So it's not like I'm Lady Gaga, you know, George Clooney, you know, where I'm so famous that I can't eat in a restaurant without somebody coming up on. So, you know, I'm well known within the world of jazz, and that's tolerable. I mean, that's not so that it interferes with your comfort, you know what I'm saying? It's not like being a rock star or something, so I don't mind people, you know, the few people, the few jazz fans that there are in the world, for me to have some notoriety. That's not a problem. But now, I will say this. It in itself has no meaning for me.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's not like my, let me see, how do you put this? It's my, the kind of, you know, everybody's got an ego, but everybody's ego is different, you know.
Yeah.
My egoic, whatever you want to call it, it's not like I get off on that, on anything being, you know, famous or that. I might get off, my ego might work a different way, but that one, it doesn't really say, it does. I'm not there with that. I don't care about that, really, you know.
Sure.
I tell you what I do, my egoic, you know, whatever you want to say about that, is I really like being respected by other musicians.
Yeah.
This means more to me than if somebody, if Joe the plumber knows me or not. So my ego is that way, you know. However, if Joe the plumber likes me, then I'm okay with that, for sure, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I get off on, you know, some saxophone player, some musician says nice things about me. I feel good about that, you know.
Yeah.
So, there's, you know, so that's where my thing is.
Right on. What's one of the nicest things a fan has ever said to you or done for you?
Well, some of the nice things that make a guy like me feel good would be if they come, I meet somebody in a jazz club, and this has happened before, and they say, you know, I never really liked jazz, and I've never really been to a jazz club or heard jazz live, and this really, this really moved me. I had no idea that this, you know, really moved me. Now, that makes me feel good because this person is not so inclined to care about what you're doing anyway. And for them to say that, it means that meeting me, I might have a quality that transcends somebody who's already inclined, you know, which makes a guy like me feel like there are elements of what I might want to do musically or how I express music that has some universal appeal and not just to the esoteric few.
Yeah.
So that for a person like me makes me feel good, because if you can make a person like that, then that means maybe you do have a nuance of universal appeal some sort of way. And that's great to me. I mean, I like that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I certainly like to appeal to the base. If we were talking about politics, I certainly want to appeal to my base.
Yeah.
But if I can make somebody who's independent like me, I'm part of it.
Yeah, right on.
Yeah.
What's the greatest thing about waking up every day?
Well, waking up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one. And to wake up and feel good physically.
Yeah.
That's great, because you can wake up and not feel good.
Yeah.
So I would say to wake up and actually feel, it feels great to wake up and not have any deep, dark shadows or forebodings over your head that's, you know, looming. Let's say that.
Yeah.
You know.
Right on.
And enjoy that while you can.
Yeah.
Because believe you me, if you live long enough, there's going to be some dark shadows and some, you know, some looming negativity that's looming. So to wake up and not have that is great.
Amen.
Yeah, and to feel good of mind and spirit and body. That's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
And you don't know how wonderful it is until you don't have it.
Yeah, true.
So while you got it, celebrate it.
Right on.
Okay. So that's a wonderful thing. The other thing is to pursue what it is that you want to do. I mean, I think you're supposed to get up, and let's assume that, you know, that you're free of all this shadowy stuff we're talking about right now. And so you just pursue your goal, whatever it is, you know. And it's a bunch of little goals that need to be, it's just to the acquisition of finishing whatever it is you need to finish. I don't care if it's raking the grass, if it's finishing a tune, or finishing an article, or finishing anything. To have something to do and then complete it to a point, you know, and to just to have this feeling of a liquidity of a, I don't know, it's just like movement, you know, movement. Things being done, and you know. So for me, I just try to. If I can have a good practice day, practice 3 or 4 hours, maybe write or two, taking care of some kind of business, and then that's it.
Right on.
Next day is, yeah. So it's not just trying to be happy and productive. Basically, that's really it. Try to be productive and basically happy.
That's cool.
Let's put it that way.
Yeah. So speaking of accomplishments, and your legendary career, what is left to accomplish for you?
Well, as I said before, the journey is the whole, to me, it's not just music, it's the journey. This might sound corny too, but I think that the journey is like basically an evolution of consciousness for each individual. And music, I mean, I have to do music. I mean, music is my game in terms of how I take care of myself and what I want to do. It's my passion. But it all alludes to a journey, a life journey, if you want to call it that. And in some kind of way, whether it's on purpose or not, or even known by the person, it's like evolution of consciousness, some sort of way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you don't even have to know it. I mean, you don't have to be cognizant of it because it's going on whether you know it or not.
Yeah.
Whether it's right up in the frontal lobes or it's back somewhere in the subconscious. But that's what's happening, you know. So I don't know if we're humans on a spiritual journey or spirit people on a human journey, whichever way you want to look at it. But some kind of way I get a feeling it is a journey.
Yeah.
And it's just the evolving of thought,
yeah,
and how you use it, which affects behavior, how you behave, and I could be totally wrong. It could be nonsense. None of this could make sense. It could be just no sense, no symmetry to none of it, and it very well could be that way. But I get the feeling that it is some kind of evolution of consciousness going on.
I got one last question for you.
Yep.
What would be one really cool thing about Charles McPherson the world may not know about, but you wouldn't mind letting them know about?
Well, let me see. I don't know if it would be interesting to anybody. It's a hard one. I don't know if I really care what the world. I don't know if I've never thought of that. I guess I'm egotistical enough to want people to like me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That doesn't hurt, I don't want people to not like. So that's kind of nice. So I guess, but that's something I wouldn't want to tell the world.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because it's self-serving, is another form of egotism. So I don't know if I would want to tell the world that. We were talking about the journey and about music and the cosmos and how it fits in with human behavior and what it's all about and all of that. I guess I don't really care if the world knows it or not, but my whole thing is that it's like music is what I do, but it's informed by how I'm thinking about this human journey we talked about, evolution of consciousness. How do I fit in with the cosmos? Not of this of the planet, but the whole thing. The galaxy, everything. Who in the hell are we?
Yeah.
Who are we? Why? What is it? Does any of it make sense? Is there some kind of, are we supposed to do this? Or how are we? And so I'm always thinking of that. And I'm always thinking of music. So that's really who I am. I mean, I'm thinking, my head is always in the clouds about those things. I'm not very mundane where I'm down to earth and I'm sort of thinking about, let me see how I'm going to get this next dollar. I should be that, maybe. but if I were a rich man and I could push a button, I would be doing exactly what I would be playing music and not worrying about money, and I would be thinking about the cosmos and not thinking I'm wasting time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
But in terms of the people, I would want to
I think you did answer it. I think you just did. I think that's the answer.
I mean, I'm a seeker, but even if I'm a fool, I am a seeker.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't mind the world knowing that.
Yeah. No, that's a great answer. That's a great answer. Yeah. Charles, you spent some quality time with me today, and I really appreciate it. Oh, man, you're a fascinating cat, man. I love your music, and just getting to know you a little bit more is just adding to the beauty of your music. I appreciate you spending a little time with me.
All right, thank you so much.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to yet another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in San Diego, New York, KC, and spots all over America, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to the legendary Charles McPherson for his cool wit, stories, and his time. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino on the iTunes Store. Or for all things Neon Jazz, you can visit the neonjazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the music, my friends.
Neon Jazz.